Welcome to the Bill Kelly Podcast. I'm Bill Kelly. Well, as part of the global news investigation, Canadian intelligence has warned Trudeau that China is allegedly targeting Canada with a sweeping campaign of foreign interference. What do we need to do to protect ourselves? Education support workers in the province are back at the bargaining table today trying to work out a deal. How that goes? Well, we'll find out from Colin DeMello. And we get the main takeaways from the 2022 midterm election south of the border with Elliot Tepper, Emeritus Professor of Political Science at Carleton University. It's all coming up in the Bill Kelly Podcast, and it starts now.
Today on the Bill Kelly Show on 900 CHML.
Yesterday on the program, we talked with global investigative reporter Sam Cooper with a rather startling revelation, and that, of course, is about Chinese involvement, and I'd prefer to call it Chinese interference in Canadian elections. As part of the global investigation, Sam found out that sources were telling the Prime Minister and basically warning him of Canadian intelligence that China is allegedly targeting Canada with a sweeping campaign of foreign interference. Here's some of Sam Cooper's report.
Sources tell Global News that Canada's spy agency, CSIS, first reported the allegations to the Prime Minister and several members of his cabinet in January. Chief among the allegations, a claim that China used its Toronto consulate during the 2019 federal election to fund an underground network of at least 11 candidates, all with suspected ties to the Chinese Communist Party. Briefings and memos detailed other examples of China's alleged efforts to sway Canada's democracy, including agents placed in the offices of members of parliament and campaigns targeting those Canadians seen as threats by the Chinese government. In a statement, CSIS confirmed the Chinese Communist Party is using all the tools at its disposal to carry out activities that pose a direct threat to Canada's national security and sovereignty.
Thank you, Sam. And let's just put this in clear terms for you. This is not something that might happen. This is something that is already happening. And the Prime Minister and the Cabinet should be well aware of this and should be taking action on this. Joining us to talk about this is Marcus Kolga. Marcus is the director of disinfowatch.org and also a senior fellow with the McDonald Laurier Institute. Marcus, thank you so much for joining us. Pleasure to have you on a very important issue today.
Yeah, thanks for having me on, Bill, and hello from sunny Vilnius, Lithuania.
Now, what are you doing over there?
I'm participating in a couple of conferences that are actually looking at how to defend our democracies from the threat of foreign authoritarians, the exact kind of stuff that Sam Cooper reported on in his report, and the same sort of interference that we've seen from Russia and the United States, Canada, and so many other places.
Well, I'm glad you put this in perspective. This is not a Canada-only problem. We know that there's concern about Chinese and Russian elements trying to infiltrate American politics and other countries in the UK. We've heard those stories as well. So this is a global problem, and I'm not surprised that the heads are getting together here to try to find some solutions to this, because, as I mentioned just before you joined us, this is happening. Yeah. This isn't say, well, hey, this could actually go on here. We better be careful. We've got to root it out at this stage.
Yeah, you're absolutely right, Bill. And look, our intelligence agencies, civil society experts like myself, have been warning Canadians and the Canadian government of this threat for the past number of years. In fact, I started writing about this already in around 2012, 2013, because I saw the threat in Europe and the growth of that threat. But this report that Sam Cooper has published is extremely serious. I think that a lot of us, again, reading between the lines in some of these public reports that CSIS and CSE has put out, I think we've all been warned, sufficiently warned, that there is this interference going on. But the scope of this, the fact that he has shed a light, a very stark light, on facts of how China is directly seeking, and not just seeking, but is actively undermining our democracy, is quite frankly quite shocking. And I think that the government needs to take very, very quick action, because the effect of this, the effect of the report, the fact that we know that China has been doing this, it threatens to erode public trust in our elections, our democratic processes, our institutions. And so we need to get to the bottom of this. We need accountability right away. And I'll tell you, the fact that this report came out 3 years after the incidents happened is also quite shocking. Why was the Prime Minister only informed of this in January? Why was he not informed of this when it was happening? Did CSIS only find out about it later, or was it, did they know about when it was happening? So there are a lot of questions here, but the government really needs to start moving on this file very, very quickly.
Do they take this stuff seriously? I mean, because as you say, you've been talking about this for almost 10 years now. Others have tried to raise the red flag. And I heard the Prime Minister's comments yesterday when he was presented with this. Well, he has the information, but when the global report came his way, and he says, yeah, we're aware that China and some other places are playing around with our institutions. It's the phrase. Isn't that playing? This is a threat to our national security.
Yeah, well, it wasn't just that. He said that China is playing games. This is not a game. The Chinese government doesn't see this as a game. The Chinese government is engaging in weaponizing information and influence, again, to undermine the core foundations of our democracy. There is nothing funny or fun about that. It is a serious national security threat that requires an immediate response. And, you know, one of those first things that I think that the government needs to be doing is ordering a formal and sweeping investigation. If it's truly found that Chinese government money was in fact used by 11 or more candidates, and if laws were broken, charges need to be laid. If there were Chinese agents, as alleged in the report, who were placed on the staff of members of parliament, or any of those candidates that might have received funds, and if they broke laws, they need to be charged. And I would argue, most importantly, that if there is any sitting MP or MPP at the moment who was close to any of this activity, they need to be identified, and they need to resign immediately for the good of our democracy.
Well, I don't want to get into the names, but I'm told the names are in the report that CSIS gave to the Prime Minister. And one MPP from the Toronto area apparently was part of the conduit here where this money was flowing. And a number of MPs, this is spy stuff. This is like James Bond stuff. And I'm not trying to be flippant about this, but it's actually happening. And, as I was reading this last night, Marcus, I couldn't help but think of like the Manchurian candidate. What better way? Put your people in there at the highest level and try to influence policies and decisions. And that's really what they're doing here. And we don't know, I guess, at this stage, how extensive this is.
Right. We don't know that yet. I mean, this may be the tip of a much bigger iceberg. And when you combine it with the other things that we've discovered, other interference that China has been engaging in over the past couple of years, it does paint a very scary picture. We know that there are at least three police stations, Chinese government police stations that are operating, one in Toronto and two in Markham. They've been identified. These police stations, we know that the Chinese government could be using those police stations to intimidate Chinese speakers in Canada to try and control them, which also represents a direct threat to our democracy and the rights of those Chinese Canadians. We also know for a fact that China tried to directly interfere in the 2021 elections. So this is, the 2021 wasn't the first time now. We know that. It happened in 2019. Now, what we do know about 2021 is that the Chinese state media tried to inject false narratives about specific political parties in Canada in using their state media. There was also a clandestine campaign to attack, in a coordinated campaign to attack sitting incumbent MPs who had been critical of the Chinese government. And so when you put all this together, I mean, again, the picture it paints is quite scary. And, it sort of is, James Bondish and quite insidious, all of this. It requires a very serious response. And I think we need to overhaul our entire intelligence system to ensure that our democracy and Canadians are protected from this sort of interference, because clearly there are big enough loopholes that the Chinese government has exploited, perhaps to its benefit.
one of the concerns here, just as we connect the dots, I'm glad you brought up about the greater security system, because we've heard stories over the last couple of months now, Marcus, that the other partners in the Five Eyes, the UK, Australia, and the United Americans, are looking at Canada right now as the weak link, not just because we're not pulling our weight, but because we are such a porous security system here that apparently the Iranians, the Russians, and the Chinese can kind of come and go as they please here.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I mean, there's another report that sort of, I mean, I think Canadian media reported on it, but very lightly. The Norwegians arrested a man who had been working in one of their universities in the Arctic and charged him with espionage. It turns out this person who had claimed that he was a Brazilian student was actually a Russian GRU colonel. Now, what's the Canadian connection to this is actually quite shocking. This person, this GRU colonel, had been placed in Canada, had earned his degree at Carleton University, and went on to the University of Calgary and did his master's there, and actually worked on at least one political campaign in the Calgary area. This is a GRU colonel. This is military intelligence. This agent was operating freely in Canada. So when you connect this with what we're hearing about China, yeah, I think that our allies, when they see these reports, are probably quite concerned and wondering how our intelligence system is working or how it's actually failing us. You know, this needs a broader investigation as well. Does CSIS have the resources it needs? Is it thin on resources? Does it need more? Are our laws insufficient? You know, clearly there, as I mentioned earlier, there are enough loopholes that the Chinese government, it seems the Russians are exploiting those as well. So we really need to take a broader look at our entire intelligence system and our national security to make sure that these foreign authoritarians aren't able to exploit it and undermine and subvert our democratic processes and quite frankly undermine the trust and the cohesion, which is the ultimate goal that they have, is to undermine the cohesion of our society and break down the trust within it.
Do we have that focus? I know that when we talked in the past about some of the activities of CSIS, and some would suggest they're spending a lot of time focusing on terrorism, and maybe that's legitimate, and that needs to happen, certainly, because that's a threat, yeah, too. But espionage and counter-espionage doesn't get talked about a whole lot, and it happens all the time. And this is not new either. And you know, you just described a perfect example of it. You know, the Russian agents in this country are not walking around in trench coats and standing like Boris and Natasha. They're people that are ingrained in our society and in our communities. And, you know, CSIS, all of our agencies have to do a better job.
Yeah. Well, look, we wouldn't have known about this Russian agent had it not been for the Norwegians catching him. You know, had the Norwegians not caught him, we would still have, you know, just assumed that this was some Brazilian guy that studied at our universities. And it begs the question, how many others are there? So, you know, and I think that CSIS, you know, I think they're doing all that they probably can. You know, they have considerable restrictions on the work that they're doing. The fact that this information was leaked out from the CSIS report is actually quite surprising, because they run a pretty tight ship over there and they don't let this sort of information leak out. But I would argue that maybe it's time to reform some of those restrictions, give them a little bit more power, allow them to speak publicly when they see these sorts of threats, rather than waiting for some approval from cabinet, so that Canadians are aware of these threats when they're happening. It doesn't help us, quite frankly, to learn about this three years later. You know, we need, when these sorts of when foreign agents, foreign authoritarian regimes are engaging in this sort of interference activity, we need to know about it when it's happening, so that we can make the right political decisions, our government can make the right decisions in order to protect our democracy. So, you know, it's good that we know this now, but 3 years later is too late. We need to make sure that our intelligence communities, our authorities have the tools to expose these threats as they're happening, so that our democracy isn't undermined.
Well, I know we're just about out of time, but this whole thing reminds me of the two Chinese-Canadian scientists that were working in the Winnipeg area on COVID vaccines and the virus itself, all of a sudden in the middle of the night just scooted up and they were gone. And they ended up back in China. And, you know, and somebody finally, hey, two and two, maybe they were agents. Yeah, maybe they were. you know, we've got to do a better job of it. That's all there is to it. Yeah.
That's right.
Anyway, you got to get back to your conference. Mark, that's right. Salves, thank you for the time today. I really do appreciate it. Let's stay in touch.
Anytime, Bill. Thanks for having me on.
Take care. Marcus Kolga, director of disinfowatch.org and senior fellow at the McDonald Laurie Institute. And invite right over there in Eastern Europe right now at one of these conferences, deciding and trying to develop some strategies on what we and other Western nations can do to protect ourselves against this kind of espionage.
You're listening to the Bill Kelly Show podcast on 900 CHML.
We seem to have diffused a very volatile situation when the Ford government basically stepped back from their threat to, first of all, use the notwithstanding clause and, of course, the back-to-work legislation. And we saw, well, we carried those press conferences right here on the program. So you heard the premier and the education minister talk about that and, of course, the union representative. Here's the thing, though. As difficult as that was, and it was pretty tight there for the last 3 or 4 days heading into that session, now they got to negotiate a contract. And that's the difficult part, because there's still some differences that have to be worked out. Bring us up to speed on what's happening. Pleased to welcome back to the program Colin DeMello. Colin, of course, is the Queen's Park Bureau Chief for Global News. Colin, welcome to the show. Good to have you with us again today.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Hey, listen, before we get into the negotiations or where they are right now, there's a sticky little issue here that I know you've been talking about, and I just wanted to bring it to our listeners' attention. When the premier announced that he was going to pull this back and they were going to, you know, take back the legislation, et cetera, he said we were going to do it right away. Technically, he can't do that, can he?
Well, no, not right now, and that's because the legislature isn't sitting. So historically, MPPs always take a break around this week, Remembrance Day week, because they have to be out in their constituencies, right? And they've got to do that constituency work. And so as a result, the legislature isn't sitting right now. Now, the premier has one of two options. He could either wait until next Monday to do it, which is the option he's taking, or he could recall the legislature back. They could just do it with an a cabinet order to call the legislature back. The government is not taking that option, and it seems like the union is a bit upset about it, because the union seems to be indicating that they were told it would be repealed immediately, and it's not being repealed immediately, yet the union has already backed down on its strike action. So I think they're kind of looking at the government with a bit of suspicion right now.
I wonder why. I mean, how could they possibly be skeptical? These two sides have gotten along so well over the years. But he said sarcastically. But I noticed the same sense of frustration there from some of the union members when they looked at this. I mean, they're kind of looking at this and say, wait a minute. And you know, because of this technicality. And that's the way the government's characterizing it. It's just a technicality. You know, we'll do this on Monday. Would you be surprised if the union was a little reticent to actually sit down and talk then until this actually gets done?
Well, listen, this is one of the reasons that the union wanted all of this in writing. Remember on Monday, when the premier had made his promise that he was going to pull back the legislation, the union refused to accept it until they got it specifically in writing. And it was lawyers. It was government lawyers. It was union lawyers who sat down and hammered that out. So this is kind of, you know, a legally binding contract, if you want to call it that, between the union and the government, for the government to pull. The province isn't going to renege on this, because they know the potential consequences for doing that. But at the end of the day, I mean, you know, they are still on thin ice with the union here, and the union could be in strike position at any point. So they could, you know, withdraw their services again if the government doesn't hurry this up.
And if that were the case, and I know we're kind of going down the road of the hypothetical here, though, if that were the case, or if the union just said, wait a second here, no, this isn't working, can the government reintroduce back-to-work legislation? Or is that verboten because of this deal?
No, I mean, the government has in its power to do whatever it wants, right? I mean, if we look at this, let's say, a few weeks down the road, and, you know, they're still arguing over a contract, and they can't come up with an agreement. Well, the government could always reintroduce legislation to impose a contract and perhaps maybe avoid using the notwithstanding clause. Because remember, back in 2012, when Dalton McGuinty did it, they were taken to court and they lost in court. And they had to, the government had to pay all these unions, these fees for imposing that contract. But the fees that they had to pay to the union were a lot less than what they saved in not giving them those huge contract increases. And so, you know, it was an overall net gain or net win for the government. So, you know, perhaps they might bring that out again. But I think once you've touched the live wire and you've gotten shocked, you know, I think the premier might be reticent to actually touch it again.
Well, yeah, I mean, you've been reporting from the halls of Queen's Park for a long, long time. What's your spidey sense tell you about this? Is that the premier sincere about this, and this is just a delay that he didn't really acknowledge or realize at the time you made the statement? Or do you think there's something untoward happening here?
Well, I mean, listen, you know, right after the election, they started talking about the possibility of making teachers essential service workers, and they backed away from those ideas. I mean, they were looking at how to kind of limit or put a circle around the unions to avoid, you know, any kind of job action. This was the intent right from the very beginning. So, I mean, the unions have been questioning whether the government has been engaging in these negotiations in good faith. That will be, you know, forever an argument, because there are going to be two sides and two sets of arguments on that. But at the end of the day, I mean, the government, you know, was filled with this desire to make sure that schools weren't interrupted after the pandemic. Their methods, though, could be questionable. And the premier has yet to reveal who was it that approved this, who was it that gave him the advice and told him that this was a good idea, whether it was the Minister of Education or the premier himself. But we've seen in the past, particularly with the pandemic, once the premier is kind of faced with the consequences and widespread negative reaction, he's pretty quick to pull back. And so this is pretty, you know, on brand for the premier, right? Does something controversial, sees an enormous amount of backlash, and immediately pulls out, tail between his legs, comes out, apologizes to everyone, and says, you know, my bad, we won't do it again. It's left to be seen whether the public will accept this ultimately as, you know, the contrition that the premier is putting out there, or whether they're looking at this as a government making a colossal, you know, bungling error.
When they do sit down at the table, interestingly enough, there will be a mediator, as per most of these negotiations, like kind of a middle person to try to quell things down. So I figure that's probably going to be the equalizer there, to make sure that things don't get too heated on either side of the table.
This is all being done through a mediator, because you have to remember, we're going back. It's almost like you have to delete last week from the calendar as if it didn't exist, right? Because we're going back to the way things were before the notwithstanding clause was introduced and the union went on strike. They were discussing everything solely through a mediator. And it's the mediator who's now back at the bargaining table and making sure that the two sides are, you know, kind of playing nice. So the government presented a contract offer yesterday. They wouldn't tell us exactly what it is, but they did say it was an improved offer, really targeting those lowest income earners within this particular union. And so they have to present their offer not to the union, but to the mediator, who then takes it to the union and tries to massage the union to see if they'll accept it or not. This is a very skilled mediator who's been able to, you know, land a number of deals with public sector unions before, and they're really hoping that he'll be able to pull it out this time. So, but this time around, though, the union seems to have a bit of the upper hand, because they've, you know, barked and they've shown the premier that they can bite, and the premier seems to know that they will do it again, you know, if this doesn't go their way. So I think they feel like they can maybe extract a little bit more from the province this time around.
What's this going to do? I don't want to get too far ahead of ourselves here, but as you've been reporting, I mentioned this on Monday, I said this is kind of like a trilogy, because even if they solve this contract, the elementary school and secondary school teachers both have contracts coming up in the next little while, and they've already begun negotiations. Does what the premier did with this particular negotiation affect that? Are they going to look at that and say, look, I don't care what he vows he's going to do to us, because he'll just back down? Or do they start to play hardball with the teachers?
Well, I mean, it could go one of two ways. I mean, on one hand, the government could try to really hold the line, and the teachers know that, you know, the government is willing to introduce a contract. I think it was the use of the notwithstanding clause that particularly set off this fuse. So if he doesn't use the notwithstanding clause, you know, would they be okay to fight it in court? Remember, I mean, you have to take into account Bill 124, which imposed a 1% wage cap on all public sector unions, right? So Bill 124 is being actively fought in court right now by a number of unions, including the education unions. So they didn't hold or threaten to hold a general strike for Bill 124. So if there is another piece of legislation that maybe limits their contract increases but doesn't use the notwithstanding clause, perhaps they might not go, you know, to that extent, all the way to the cliff or the edge of the cliff. At the same time, though, the unions do know they have now power in numbers. It's not just the teachers' unions anymore. It is all of the unions, the public, the private sector, unions from Quebec that wanted to participate in the general strike next week. They've got an enormous amount of weight and force and financial resources, most importantly, behind them. So they know that they might be able to get a little bit more out of the premier. I don't know if this is all going to devolve into a strike, because parents might only tolerate one strike per bargaining session. So they may be on thin ice with parents. And ultimately, that's what it comes down to, right? If parents are not on your side, it doesn't matter what you do or what your bargaining position is. If parents aren't willing to tolerate what you're doing, then you've lost. And that ultimately is where this all will lie over the next few weeks and months.
I guess the big takeaway here is we're not anywhere near the finish line just yet, the way things are going. Colin, a busy day for you today. Really appreciate you taking some time, and we'll be watching for your reporting on this, of course, on Global News later on today. Thanks for this.
My pleasure as always. Thanks for having me.
Colin DeMello, Queen's Park Bureau Chief for Global News.
You're listening to the Bill Kelly Show podcast on 900 CHML.
Well, south of the border is where everybody's looking right now. An election to determine control of Congress south of the border, of course. Well, it started last night. They're still counting, though. And it's too close to call in many jurisdictions. A result that goes against what a lot of the polls have been predicting, that it was going to be a Republican sweep. But it could spark concern for a looming announcement from, well, the country's former president. Global's Reggie Cicchini has the details.
For weeks, Republicans had been predicted to take a majority in the U.S. House, and while it's still possible, the margins have thinned out after stronger-than-expected performances by Democrats. At the Senate level, at least one state has flipped blue after populist candidate John Fetterman defeated Dr. Mehmet Oz. Oz now joining a list of candidates backed by Donald Trump, who lost in their races, a move that could influence his looming decision to run, or the party's decision to back him, which could become a reality following a strong performance by Florida Governor Ron DeSantis, widely expected to enter the 2024 race with a hefty fundraising list and solid base. The stakes in these midterms for Americans were high, from the economy to individuals' rights, but it will be days or possibly weeks before final results are crystal clear. Reggie Cicchini, Global News, Washington.
So what does this mean in the short term and in the long term for foreign policy, for domestic policy, for instance, and a number of other elements to this? To answer these questions, please to welcome back to the program Elliot Tepper, Emeritus Professor of Political Science at Carleton University. Elliot, thanks for the time on a very busy day today. I was going to say post-election, but they're still counting, so it's not over yet, is it?
Definitely not. Good morning, Bill. Well, you know, for political scientists, this is catnip. So the the election is by no means over. It clearly is taking a different direction than anybody had anticipated. The whole question going in was, is this going to be a Republican ripple or a wave, or, as they were hoping, the Republicans, a tsunami? It looked very promising for the Republicans, with high inflation, with President Biden's ratings underwater, with the economy really being number one concern, apparently. So it looked like Joe Biden's presidency basically was going to be over today, because the Republicans were going to have such an overwhelming sweep. It was not a tsunami. It was not a wave. It's definitely a ripple. Republicans are going to do very well in terms of, yes, they'll take the House, and we should talk more about that, whether they can even hold this, their current 50-50 at the Senate remains in doubt, or at least an open question.
Well, let's talk about the House of Representatives and some of the changes there. And then I want to get into the Donald Trump influence or lack of influence in situations like this. For those who may not be totally familiar with the U.S. political situation, midterms, of course, are really halfway through the four-year term of the president. And the Congress is up for re-election, and some of the senators in any given time. And invariably, I don't care who's in the White House, Republican or Democrat, the midterms is usually the people's opportunity to smack that administration and you know, say we're not pleased. They didn't get a smack last night. They got a little tap on the wrist, really.
Yes, 100% of the House of Representatives, 435, are up for election, one-third of the Senate. That's how the U.S. Constitution works. The expectation was, as happened under President Obama, that there would be a shellacking for Joe Biden. Obama lost, I think, was 62 seats to the Republicans in his midterm. The normal reflection here is that the party that loses the presidential election is all fired up at the midterm, whereas the winner of the presidential election is relaxed, and therefore the party in power loses a lot of seats, some to a lot, at the midterm. And that was fully the expectation, particularly with inflation having wiped out what looked to be a bump for the Democrats midsummer after Roe v. Wade came down. It looked like the Democrats were going to do better than anticipated, but not, you know, it was billed as abortion versus inflation as the ballot question. That bump seemed to dissipate as inflation continued. And yes, the Republicans were anticipating a really big night, and they did not get it.
Let's talk about the Trump influence here. Donald Trump has been campaigning, well, somewhat successful for himself, but trying to endorse people like Dr. Oz and a number of other candidates, all of whom did very poorly for the most part. He wanted this, I think, Elliot, to be a big Republican win, that tsunami that you were talking about, and ride that wave to say, see, I did all this for the Republican Party, and now I'm running for president again. It didn't work out the way he wanted. Is that going to influence his choice? He says that there's a big announcement next week.
On the 15th. Yes, a lot of the candidates that he backed and he basically imposed on the Republican Party lost. A number have won. We have a segue sideways that about 370 candidates for the Republican Party at all levels, state and local and federal, national, were deniers. And about half of those did get elected. So there's about a third of the Republican caucus about to enter, it isn't finally settled in the total numbers, but about a third of the Republican caucus going into the House are election deniers. But in key states, over and over again, those people who were going to be managing the future elections because they were backed by Trump, they got defeated. We still are watching very carefully in places like Arizona. How does that affect Trump? He was indeed looking forward to a big springboard. He hinted broadly, now he's going to announce what he's been hinting at. Let's wait. All of his advisors said, wait until after the midterms. And so the midterms are over next week. Yes, I'm running for president. Will this affect that decision? The thumping win in Florida for DeSantis, DeSanctimonious, as Trump is now calling him, that too is a big factor. The fact that somebody like DeSantis might actually challenge successfully Trump in a primary, or at least might enter a primary and do well, that's a sobering thought. So basically, Trump didn't do well on election night. Trumpism did very well on election night on the Republican side in terms of DeSantis. Will that dissuade him from running? I can't answer that question, but I tell you, Bill, he's got two good reasons to enter the race officially now. The first is he would like to foreclose DeSantis or anybody else from actually declaring against him, saying, don't even bother to declare your candidacy. I'm going to win the nomination for the Republican Party. There's nothing you can do about it. Get lost. That may be drawn into question now by DeSantis's victory and Trump's relative loss. But the second thing is, if he's the official candidate, it might make it a little more, there might be hesitancy to prosecute the former president who's now running once again for the many, in the many criminal and civil cases now pending. I can't predict which way that'll wash out for him. He has an absolute command over a large swath of the Republican Party, but he did not do well in this election.
Elliot, we'll have to leave it there for now as the dust starts to settle here. With much more conversation about this we get some of the final results. Thanks so much for this today, Elliot.
Oh, you're very welcome.
Elliot Tepper, Emeritus Professor of Political Science at Carleton University. And lots more to come about the impact of this U.S. election in the next couple of days and weeks, I guess, for that matter.
The Bill Kelly Show, weekdays from 9 to noon on 900 CHML.
The Bill Kelly Podcast is available on Apple Podcast, Google Podcast, or wherever you get your podcasts from. You can also listen to The Bill Kelly Show weekdays from 9 till noon on 900 CHML. I'm Bill Kelly. Thanks again for listening. And don't forget to subscribe to the podcast. It's free, so you never miss an episode. And make sure that you rate and review.
I'm not just a pawn in this game.
Three nights a week on Global.
They're putting targets on their back. Massive.
drama.
I guess you could say I'm in a showman. They're just so in love and so annoying. Enough.
Betrayal.
The guy just put up his best friend now.
And plot twists.
What is happening right now?
You'll never see coming.
If you're coming for me,
this is perfect.
I'm coming for you then.
It'll be a battle.
Like, it'll be war.
Big Brother Canada. All new Tuesdays, Wednesdays, and Sundays on Global. Stream on Stack TV.